Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to Table Manners. I'm Jessie Ware and I really need a drink. And I'm here with my mum over Zoom. Hi mum.
And I've had a drink. I've sat and watched the footy. Stop halfway.
Oh yeah, aren't we 2-0 up?
Yeah, it's a bit like the Euros or the World Cup when you watch football at 6 in the evening rather than normal time.
Well, I prefer that than the new Premier League 8 o'clock time. I'm not into that.
Yeah, it's too late.
Well, speaking of footballers, the guest that we've got on tonight...
is a footballer?
No, got scouted by Arsenal when he was young and his parents didn't let him go.
Maybe that was a wise move.
Well, instead he just went on to be one of the best actors we've got. Can we say we've got him because he's actually Welsh?
No.
So Wales have. Is it a bit like Ryan Giggs? We want him so much to be our very own.
What do you mean? I'm not English, I'm European.
Are you?
Yeah.
Well, what am I?
You're European.
Yeah. Okay, cool. So we've got the incredible Michael Sheen.
We could be Welsh.
Really?
Well, our niece, your cousin, lives in Wales.
Just because we had a chalet in Abersock in the 80s doesn't mean that we are Welsh. Well, I'm incredibly excited to speak to Michael. Not only is he a fantastic actor that we've all seen in so many brilliant things. You may have seen him recently in ITV's quiz where he played Chris Tarrant with like the most, it was Trumpish fake tan. I didn't realise Chris Tarrant was so orange. But anyway, he's brilliant. Frost Nixon, Twilight.
Oh, he was in The Good Fight, my favourite.
Oh, was he?
Yeah.
Oh.
He plays the most annoying person in it.
The Good Fight gets loads of corker actors.
Oh, it was just brilliant. But he played a very annoying person. But he also has played Tony Blair and Richard Nixon. But I wouldn't mind if he didn't do anything tonight, but just did the prologue from Under Milkwood, which he did when he appeared in that, the Welsh production of it.
Oh, that was, yeah.
Sensational.
And most recently, I've been watching Staged, which is, I think, the first lockdown drama.
Oh, yeah, with David Tennant.
It's so good. Curb Your Enthusiasm / The Trip. It's David Tennant and Michael Sheen playing themselves, trying to get this play up and running in lockdown. There's a Samuel L. Jackson cameo, which is so good. And they're just both really excellent, aren't they? So I've been really enjoying that. But also, something close to both our hearts is that we are both UNICEF ambassadors. And I've watched Michael Sheen speak at one of the UNICEF Halloween balls and him to command the whole room. He's been on, I think, many more trips than me, but we have both been to Bangladesh, to Cox's Bazaar, to meet the Rohingyas. And I'd love to hear his take on that and to see whether he has any updates about the people that he met. But, you know, it's a hard time for charities at the moment to be raising money. UNICEF, you know, would have had Soccer Aid happening in June and couldn't make it happen. And that's one of their huge sources of money, much like the marathon can go ahead. And that's worrying when there's a pandemic going on and places like Cox's Bazaar and the refugee camps, the biggest refugee camp in the world, is struggling to even get clean water. So anyway, I'm sure we'll talk about this all with Michael Sheen. Michael Sheen tuning in from South Wales, I think. I can't wait. Michael, thank you for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
How are you? How's the sleep?
Okay, the sleep is a bit tricky at the moment. Babies just cut two teeth simultaneously.
Oh, teeth are a bugger.
Yeah, I know. If only we didn't use them.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
We could just give everything a nasty suck instead.
God.
That would be good, wouldn't it? So she's a bit, she's a bit disturbed by that.
Oh, so rubbish. Moment.
And it's very hot. It's very hot here today as well, particularly.
Where are you? Are you in North or South Wales?
I'm in South Wales, on the edge of what is known as the Brecon Beacons, Breconshire National Park.
Oh, it's beautiful.
Yeah, gorgeous.
Is that where you're from?
Yeah, so I'm from, this is technically Neath Portalbert, and I'm from Portalbert originally. My family is still there. My mum and dad are there. And my sister's just a bit further up the road with her family. So I'm back in Portalbert, essentially. But I'm just a little bit into the country. When I grew up in Portalbert, I didn't even know there was countryside anywhere near Portalbert. It was just the steelworks and the beach. But there is a bit. So you get closer to Breconshire. And so I'm just out there surrounded by sheep and llamas. There are llamas in the field next door, I noticed today.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Amazing. They're really odd looking.
Oh, wow. Are you near Abergavenny by any chance?
Abergavenny?
No, I'm not near Abergavenny. I mean, nowhere's that far away in Wales, but I'm not near Abergavenny, no.
I hear that's really foodie. Like, it's a big old foodie place.
Oh, there's a lot of very foodie places in Wales, yeah. If you go out, like, if you're driving across Wales and you go, you know, you get out of the industrial south particularly. I mean, there's some nice restaurants in the industrial south. But once you get out into, like, West Wales and Mid Wales and North Wales, you come across these amazing places. Yeah, gorgeous foodie places. And I think you're right. I think Abergavenny is quite foodie. I've heard that.
I don't know how much you know about this podcast, but we talk a bit about food and a bit about kind of growing up and food memories.
Lovely.
And but firstly, we're both UNICEF ambassadors. And
yes.
That I met you at a Halloween ball. I just got off stage listened to me because you don't do an acoustic gig at a very it's worth every penny, but you know, it's a pricey ball and nobody wants to hear an acoustic song. They want to hear like thumping music. But the way that when you went on stage and command the audience with your speech, I was like, oh God, you're actually the best. And it was really inspiring and it was a pleasure to meet you. But yeah, so we are both UNICEF ambassadors.
Oh, that night, you're bringing back real terrible, like, NAM flashbacks now. That was the worst gig I've ever had to do. Because, you know, nobody wants to, if you think nobody wants to hear an acoustic song, nobody certainly wants to hear someone come out and talk about the work that UNICEF is doing. You know, people are out for a night out. They're, you know, quite well-to-do people, not used to having to shut up for others. And I had to walk out there thinking, no one is going to listen. And I'm about to put my heart out there. Like, I'm talking about my daughter and seeing children going through terrible things, and it was just horrendous. And I went out and I had to muster every single bit of whatever I've got in me that tries to make people listen to me. And people did. People shut up. I couldn't believe it. They actually listened. I was amazed.
It was the performance of your life.
I think it was. And, you know, only those people saw it.
Well, I saw it and it was amazing.
Well, thank you.
How did you get involved with UNICEF?
Originally, it was through Soccer Aid. I took part in Soccer Aid as the captain of the rest of the world team for many years. I think I started in 2010, I think it was. And, you know, I was a huge football fan. I mean, I wanted to play football professionally when I was a kid.
Yeah, you got scouted, didn't you?
I sort of did, yeah. I was on a family holiday at Pontins on the Isle of Wight when I was 12. And Tony Adams' dad was also on holiday with a very young Tony Adams. And long story short, I ended up being offered to go and play for the Arsenal youth team.
Wow. Did you and Tony have a kickabout?
Oh, I skinned him. Skinned it.
That is amazing.
I think you dodged a bullet. You wouldn't have wanted to play for Arsenal, Mike.
Did you give him his bad back?
That's a whole other story, Jesse. No, the chances of ever making it to the first team of a club like that, I mean, are so remote, you know. So,
well, Tony Adams did, and you were better than him.
Well, I'm saying that I was 12, and he was 15 or 16, and I think he let me run rings around him a little bit. But
more modest,
yeah.
He was off season; it's a holiday.
Exactly,
yeah, no,
yeah.
Sure.
He just had a big lunch, But I didn't go down that route because my mum and dad said, no, you can't go and live in London. You're only 12 and we're not moving. That makes them sound like they weren't supportive. They were very supportive, but there was just no way that could happen then. So I didn't go down the football route, but I was still very into football. And when I got to about, I guess when I got to about 13, 14, I started to get into acting and doing youth theatre and plays. And so it kind of switched then. My obsession switched. But early on, I was very into football. So years later, when I'm asked, do you want to be the captain of the rest of the world and play with people like Zinedine Zidane and, you know, incredible. At Old Trafford, how in front fabulous. Of, you know, 80,000 people or whatever. I mean, it was an amazing experience. So I jumped at it. And to be honest, I barely noticed UNICEF had anything to do with it, to be honest. But then once you're there and you're part of it, the people from UNICEF come and sort of talk to you a bit about, you know, what the money's going to go towards and all that kind of thing. And I was sort of fascinated by it. And they show you a little, you know, films and things that other ambassadors have done. And so through that, then they asked if I would be interested in getting more involved and maybe going on a visit, a trip somewhere. So I started off going to, the first trip I did was to Chad in Africa. And it was, they were sort of letting me in easy a bit just to see sort of, you know, it wasn't too distressing.
Had that too.
But even so, that was kind of mind blowing really when I went to that. That really opened my eyes in all kinds of ways about things. And then I went on from there then and visited places like the Syrian refugee camp in Lebanon. Eventually, I went to the Zaatari camp in Jordan as well, the Syrian refugee camps. I went to Guatemala. And the last time I went on a trip was to Bangladesh, to the Kutubalong camp at in Cox's Bazar there with all the Rohingya refugees, which I think you've been to as well. You've been to that one.
Yeah. So I went in 2017 in December when the Rohingya people had fled from Myanmar. And that was in August, the big influx of refugees that entered into Bangladesh. And so I went 4 months after that.
Right.
And it was really harrowing and really, I mean, just so upsetting. And they were just kind of setting up the camps, even though it was already the biggest refugee camp in the world.
Yeah. And has got bigger.
Yeah. So when did you go?
Well, I was there in 2018 as well, in April. So I was there just before the monsoon was about to start in around sort of, they thought in about June time, but it's kind of, you know, any time around there. March to, I think, July is sort of one period of time. And then I think September to December is another cyclone seasons. But the big fear was that here was this huge camp that had been kind of deforested, the hillsides deforested to just build, you know, to put settlements on. And of course, if the rains were to come, if the monsoon rains were to hit hard, then the flash floods and landslides, you know, was a terrifying prospect with so many people there. I mean, at that point, when I was there, I think there was maybe like 500,000 people or something like that. I mean, there's now 854,000 people, I think, in the camp now. But, you know, it was massive enough at the time. And the thought of the destruction that could come from the monsoon was sort of terrifying. And so the idea was that I would go, I would see what was happening, and then I would come back and be able to talk about it and try and get support for the monsoon season for people to sort of mitigate the potential destruction that could come with that. And whilst I was there at the camp, and I, you know, I'm sure like you said, the thing that hits you is just the size of it, the scale of it, the amount of people there, and knowing that half of the camp are children.
Yeah.
And just seeing the conditions, you know, just literally just bits of cardboard and bits of corrugated iron, if you're lucky, and some bamboo and that, you know, just all piled on. And I remember being up on a slightly raised hill area and seeing pretty much the entire camp around me. And I was reduced to just, you know, I couldn't catch my breath. It was extraordinary to see the scale of it and to think of what could happen with the monsoon. So, and I remember as I was there, the rain started.
Oh, wow.
And this just torrential thing just started happening. And it was terrifying. You were seeing not only the workers there in the camp, but also the refugees themselves, volunteers, starting to try and tie things down and do what they could to help, you know. And it really was terrifying. And that was just the beginnings of a taste of what the monsoon could do. It was extraordinary that I was there to sort of witness that.
You think about that, there's a survival instinct, the fact that they had to flee Myanmar and, you know, the atrocities that they've seen, and then monsoon hits. And then you get COVID-19. And then it's, yeah. You know, I don't know if you've been, I got a call from one of the UNICEF people on the ground and an update about what it's like in Cox's Bazar with COVID. And they've only got like 43 confirmed cases and 4 deaths. Yeah. But it's apparently because they're too scared to go in and get tested, because if you were tested positive, you'd be taken into isolation. And some of these mothers can't risk leaving their children on their own.
Right.
And then there's a stigma attached to if you get a positive result. So they're just not getting tested out of fear. Yeah. And you know what it was like. They were so close to each other.
Yeah.
I mean, you can imagine there's far more than 43 cases.
Yeah, I mean, you can't social distance there. No. It's just ridiculous. And, you know, just being able to wash your hands, do things as basic as washing your hands is really hard there as well. And just to get the information across, like you say, you know, the stigma is there. There's always cultural things that are difficult to kind of cut through. And, of course, the fact that there are so many children there, on the one hand, you think, oh, well, children aren't suffering from it as much, it seems, so that's good. But the children who are there, you know, two of the things that affect people in the camps the most are acute respiratory disease and diarrhea. And so and both of those things hit children under 5 really hard. Mm. So you've got children who should be, you know, not suffering from it as much. But actually, so many of them have got underlying conditions that make them even more vulnerable. So the prospect of what could happen there, like you said, at the moment, as far as I know, yes, just only 4 deaths reported in the camp and, you know, quite low cases. But if it was to really start run rampant there, it's terrifying what could happen.
Growing up in South Wales, what was it like? How many, have you got any siblings? And what was it like around the dinner table? What's a memorable meal from your childhood?
So I have one sister who is 3 years younger than me, Joanne. And growing up, the dinner table was not the most fancy of places. I'll give you an example. This will tell you a lot. So when I was, I'd already moved to London. I'd been in London for years. I'd had my first daughter, Lily, had been born. My mum and dad came down to London to visit. So this was what, about 15, 16 years ago, maybe. And we were living in West London at the time. And we went to a restaurant there. I think it was like an Ask Pasta place, you know, one of those sort of pasta chain places. And we sat down, and there was me and my partner and our little baby and my partner's parents and then my parents and my sister. And my dad looked at the menu and went, pasta! Like he had never heard of the concept. And it was sort of quite a bizarre concept. Pasta, is it? All right, pasta. I was like, what? So that gives you a sense of where I was coming from. When I left Wales and went to drama school in London, I'd already left drama school and I was living with my girlfriend and she sent me down to the shops to get some potatoes and I came back with a tin of potatoes.
Tin potatoes.
That is what I thought getting potatoes was.
And you thought that was posh, probably.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Proper. Yeah. I was treating her.
That's posh.
I was treating her. So, yeah, so there wasn't the most, I mean, you know, God bless my mum. She was a working mother. She was working every day. She didn't have, you know, huge amounts of time.
So what did your parents do?
So my dad was worked in personnel. I think these days they call it H&R or HR, don't they?
HR, yeah.
But in those days it was called personnel. He worked in that. He had come up, he'd done his apprenticeship in the steelworks and all that, but he had had the chance to kind of go into middle management. So that was a big step for our family. And my mum, and you know, this says a lot as well. My mum did essentially the same job as my dad in a different company, but she was called a secretary and he was called a personnel manager. So that, you know, that was always quite interesting to see how that all played out. But yeah, so my mum didn't have massive amounts of time and just it wasn't a big kind of cooking house to grow up in, to be honest. So
food wasn't that important?
It wasn't something that I didn't come to really appreciate food and really enjoy food until much later, really, until I was sort of, you know, myself working and able to go to restaurants and that kind of stuff. And
but what did they think about you wanting to go to London?
Well,
drama school.
This is the thing. I was very lucky, you see, because I not only did I come from an area that was very supportive of acting. So Portalbert, Richard Burton came from Portalbert, Anthony Hopkins came from Portalbert. So there was a real
something in the
real
water.
Respect.
Okay.
Oh yeah, real respect for acting there, you know. So there was that side of it. Then I also, you know, very lucky, come from a very supportive family. So my mum and dad were really supportive, came to see everything I did, all school plays and youth theatre and all that kind of stuff. And my family were very into amateur operatics, you know, the Amateur Operatic Society that is a, you know, a real lifeblood of the country. They were like, there used to be, I'm not sure if there is now, but there used to be like six or seven amateur operatic societies just in, you know, the Neath Portalbert area. And so I grew up going to watch my uncles and aunties and people doing, you know, Gilbert and Sullivan operas and Carousel and Brigadoon and things like that. So I grew up on that. So they were very supportive of theatre and acting. So there was a real combination there of coming from an area, a very, you know, tough working class area that you would think wouldn't be that supportive of acting and think it was a bit, you know, arty-farty. But actually, there was a real respect for acting in the area. And then a family who were very supportive. And then the kind of third column of what supported me, really, was that there was an amazing youth arts kind of infrastructure in the area, in our county. There was the youth dance company that Catherine Zeta-Jones came through. Then there was the youth theatre company that I came through, and people like Russell T. Davis came through, and all amazing people. And then there was the youth orchestra as well. And it was all supported, really, by a man called Godfrey Evans, who was the county advisor in dance and drama. He built up this thing all through the education system. So it was funded by that. And it was an amazing kind of environment for young people, you know, coming from tough backgrounds in a lot of the areas around here. And we're getting this incredible, you know, I didn't realize really until I got to drama school in London how lucky I'd been that I had already had this amazing training where I had come from, you know. And so it was extraordinary that to have all that come together. And that's really what has given me the path through life that I've had. I've come more and more over the years to appreciate how much I owe to the people who made all that happen. You know, not only my family, but also the people who put their time and energy and real commitment into building that youth arts scene up, which, of course, has all been cut back now. And it's a lot harder to have that. You know, my path to do what I've done has sort of disappeared in many ways. And that's a big reason why I'm back here for a start, and that I put as much as I possibly can into trying to create those pathways for young people and to make sure that there's access for opportunity for people, that you shouldn't be punished because you come from an area that doesn't have as much money as other areas. You know, it's just not fair, is it?
Where do you live? Is this your real home then?
Yeah, this is where I live.
Is it Los Angeles?
No, I lived in Los Angeles for many years because when me and my daughter's mother broke up, my daughter was three and they lived in Los Angeles. They wanted to live there and stayed there. So for me to be with my daughter meant being in LA. So I lived there, and I wasn't the biggest fan of it out there, to be honest. And it was lovely to visit, and I enjoyed going there, and it always felt like being on holiday. But to actually live there was tough. And it wasn't just necessarily about Los Angeles. It was about not being here. Mm. I found that really difficult. You know, a lot of British people, I'm sure you've come across people, Jesse, yourself, who just love it out there. I mean, people who just can't wait to get away from Britain and just live over there.
My sister.
Right.
My sister lives there. She's right. Like, she's an actress and she lives there, and I can't imagine her ever coming back now. That's
right.
It.
Yeah. And I find it really hard to get my head around that. I mean, fair, you know, fair play to anyone who feels like that. But for me, I'm like, I find it really hard to be away from here, you know, from this country and these people. And it's, you know, it's my tribe. That's where I come from. Yeah. And I don't like being away from it. So it was difficult. But obviously, I wanted to be with my daughter, and that was it.
So are you setting up, and please forgive me if I should know this, but are you setting up a kind of a scheme within, like, Wales for performing arts, or are you just trying to be there on the ground to try and build something up, or is it not?
It's a lot of things. I've sort of work in a lot of different areas now. Really, I made a choice a few years ago, which essentially led to me coming back and living here, where I decided that I was going to sort of shift the priority in my life, really. And so the acting side of things would now just fund everything else. So the priority for me would be working on, I mean, I don't really know what to call it. I just say non-acting stuff. I don't really know what to call it, because all the names that people come up with make my bum go in and out a little bit. I get a bit embarrassed by that.
Oh, come on, give us a few
of
them.
No, when people talk about activism or community development or charity work, which is the worst thing, I can't stand that. But It's like I say, I got to a point in my life where I realized I have a real window of opportunity in that at the moment I can pretty much work whenever I want and I get paid well for the work I do and I can choose where and when and, you know, I've got about as much control over my career as it's possible for me to have and I'm not going to have that forever. You know, I've got that now and I'm not going to have it forever. And so I have a bunch of resources. I have financial resources. I have, platform resources. I can bring people together into a room that wouldn't normally necessarily want to be in a room together. You know, I can bring groups of people and organizations together to maybe at least be open to the possibility of working together in a different way. So there's all those resources. And the one thing that I didn't have a huge amount of was time. And, you know, before, because the acting side of my life. Mm. And so I decided that I wanted to now give that extra bit, the time as well, and put all the resources that I had to use. And because I'd had a growing awareness of how much I owed to other people and the work that other people had done. And a big watershed moment for me was in 2011, where I did a project called The Passion here in Port Talbot, which was for National Theatre Wales. And it was something I worked on for a few years and developed with the community. And it was essentially a one-off performance, just one single performance that lasted nonstop for 72 hours and took place all over the town and had 2,000 local people involved in it, working on it. And it was a real changing point in my life through working with the town in that way and getting to know all the different organizations and support groups and things that and really seeing what was going on in our community that I'd never been aware of growing up. You know, until someone in very close to you dies, you don't even think about the concept of grief counseling or, you know, unless you're a carer, unless your mother, you know, your single parent mother is suffering from depression and has a physical disability of some kind and you're looking after at the age 12, you don't think of what it is to be a carer or, you know, all of these things. And it completely opened my eyes working with these organizations and seeing what they were doing and trying to involve them in the performance in some way. And so since then, I stayed connected to a lot of the work that they were doing. And it just made me have a growing awareness of not only what was going on in that community, but essentially what was going on in every community all around the country, you know, and the work that people were doing and how hard it was for them and how hard it was being made for them by all the cuts that were going on. So I sort of started to have a developing awareness of all that stuff. And I wanted to do what I could. I felt like, well, I've got resources. You know, here I am in this incredibly fortunate position. And I come from this community that I now had my eyes open to see what's going on there. I've got something to offer here, something. I mean, not much, you know, but I'll give what I have got to offer. And so I decided that that's what I was going to do. So I was going to change my priority. And whilst I have the opportunity to do all this, to do it. Because like I say, that window's not going to be there for, you know, the rest of my life. Eventually the work won't be quite the same and all the rest of it. And so I'm back here. So, yeah, so I work. So it was a very long-winded way of answering your question, which is no, I do. Amazing. So I work on a lot of different areas. I founded a thing called the End High Cost Credit Alliance a few years ago, which because I realized how much communities like near me were being exploited by just high cost credit company for people who don't have access to credit in the same way as, you know, a lot of us do. You have these companies, these payday lenders and doorstop lenders and rent to own businesses that just really exploit people who don't have much money, basically. And so I set up a thing to try and get people to work together to bring an end to that and to stop that. And I'm working on things around trying to get local journalism because we don't have a local paper here in Neath Port Talbot. So there is no access to accurate information about what's going on. There's no representation of people. There's no holding people to account in power. We get reported on by people in Bristol or if we're lucky, Swansea. And that's true of, you know, of a lot of places. And I think there's a real connection between that and people feeling engaged in the political process as well and feeling like they're, you know, represented and their voice matters in some way. So, you know, I'm working on that as well and a lot of different things.
You sound incredibly busy and time probably still is quite of the essence. And, you know, I mean, but I do love that you did this BBC. It's not a drama. It's like a what would you call it?
It's definitely
not a drama. It's a comedy.
It's mecking around.
It's kind of somewhere. And I'm so sorry to this because I hate people when they do it about my music. But for anybody who hasn't listened to it, I mean, I hope this is a huge compliment to you. It's somewhere between Curb and The Trip for me, and like two incredible bits of TV and but the chemistry with you and David Tennant is brilliant, and it's great. But I want to know, I mean, I presume you're not as grumpy as that. I can see you're not.
Oh, I can be. I can be, Jessie.
Not grumpy at all.
Not at the moment, because it's in the evening. You should see me at 9 o'clock in the morning.
Why?
I can get... I'm not a good morning person. I'm very much a night person, yes. Yes, and I can get grumpy.
Do you find you go to bed later since you've been in lockdown, that you just kind of stay up late and watch rubbish telly and... Or you probably...
Well, with the baby, you see, dictates a lot of stuff. Baby. So that's kind of different, yeah.
Tiny dictators, aren't they?
Yeah.
Are you hands-on?
Yes, absolutely, yeah. Oh, I love it. It's wonderful. I love being a dad again.
The cleverest thing I ever did was getting my husband to be able to do a bottle in the night was a game changer. And basically he parents them more than me.
That's the thing with in lockdown, you know, originally, so before lockdown happened, I was filming in New York. I do a TV series over there, which is handy because I can sort of come in and out of it a bit, and it's a good job.
Which one's that?
It's called Prodigal Son.
Oh, I know that one, but I'm desperate for The Good Fight to come back.
Oh, right, yes. Well, I was doing The Good Fight.
Is it coming back?
It's back on now at the moment, yeah, in America. Yeah, so it should be on over here soon.
Thank God.
Are you still in it?
No, I just did one season of it.
Oh, well.
I was over in New York doing, because my daughter lives there now, so I was there sort of spending time with her, and I thought, well, whilst I'm here, I might as well try and get some work. So I ended up doing The Good Fight for a season, and I wasn't planning on doing anything else, but then this other thing came up, Prodigal Son, and I thought, well, this is quite handy because I don't have to be in it all the time. I can come in and out, so I can come back home here and I can, you know, still see my daughter when I come, and I can earn a bit of money, and it's great. So I just finished filming the first series of that, and we came back to Wales, and then within 2 weeks it was lockdown or something, you know. So I had never, I wasn't going to be working over this period of time anyway. It was just going to be us here in the house with the baby, you know, just to focus on being a family and being close to my mum and dad as well. And so, you know, I haven't had my work disrupted in that way, and that I didn't get anything, you know, that I was going to do cancelled. In fact, I ended up doing an extra series. That's what's bizarre, is that I actually ended up working more than I was going to during lockdown.
Was it quite finickety with how to do it? Because were you acting in front of each other, or was everything kind of almost like a monologue with how you performed it?
Oh, no, it was all...
Or was it through Zoom?
It was like this. We did it like this.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So the thing that happened was that David and I had worked on Good Omens together a couple of years ago now, and we had such a lovely time doing that together, really got on well and seemed to have good chemistry on screen. And so I think we both were sort of hoping that something would come up for us to do together again. But it's quite rare that we'd been in a film together before, but we hadn't acted together. And of course, we realized that actually we were getting offered the same parts all the time. It was, you know, if he did it, that means that I didn't get it, and vice versa or whatever. So there was usually one David or Michael size hole in the project. And so one of us would fill it. And so we were never really in anything together. So when we did Good Omens, we just loved doing it. So then David got in touch with me and said, look, I've been sent this idea, and they asked me to ask you if you'd want to do it as well. And so we just...
So it actually is exactly what the show is.
Yes, exactly. So that's how the story of the show as well. Except in the show, I'm much less into the idea of doing it, whereas in real life, I love the idea of doing it. And so we did the first episode just, you know, for nothing, and just as an experiment to see what it would be like, not knowing whether it would work at all. And
then we did it.
Oh, no, I didn't write it. The first episode was written by two writers, Simon Evans, who directed it all and ended up writing the rest of it.
And he
co-wrote the first episode
in it as well.
Yes, and he plays himself in it as well, yeah. And so he wrote it, yeah. And so we did that first episode, and then we watched it, and we're like, oh, this is quite good. And we enjoyed doing it. We had a good time doing it. Because I was a bit wary because, of, you know, we've got a full-time job looking after the baby here at the moment.
Yeah.
So the idea of doing a job from my kitchen was a bit worrying. But actually, it worked out fine. And Anna, my partner, is in it as well, playing herself. And
yeah.
David's wife, Georgia, is in it herself as well. And so it was lovely. And you can hear Lyra, our baby, in the background in a lot of scenes as well.
I think there's something really interesting about it being a documentation of this time. And I think all the cutaways of... whether it's the Tesco aisles being empty. I don't know. It feels so far away, that time, when actually it was only a few months ago. But kind of, yeah. I thought it was brilliant. Do you think you'll ever do it again, or do you think it would never work again?
Well, who knows? I mean, in a way, the reason why it happened and the reason why it could work was because we were in lockdown and we were doing it over a laptop, you know. So obviously, once we're not in lockdown conditions, that won't apply anymore. But having said that, because we've set up the format and we've got people used to the idea of me and David acting over a laptop, of course, David and I are very rarely in the same place. So, you know, he might be away. He's filming a thing called Around the World in 80 Days. Or he was just before lockdown. He'd presumably go back to it. And he'll be all over the world. I'm here or in America or whatever. So there's no reason why we can't continue that sort of idea that we're talking to each other because we're friends over a laptop. So it's possible that we could do more if we, you know, if the idea behind it, the sort of through line is there, then maybe.
I loved it.
When you were in LA, did you miss Welsh food?
Did I miss Welsh food? Yes.
Now, what's that stew called? Is it cowl?
Cowl. I love cowl. Yes. Now, so having spoken earlier about, you know, growing up at home and the food there, doesn't mean to say that there weren't meals that I loved that my mum made. So cowl, family, my grandmother used to make cowl and my mother makes it in the tradition of my grandmother. I love that. That is amazing. My mother makes a fantastic boiled ham, peas, potatoes and parsley sauce. That was a big Saturday meal for us.
Ooh.
I loved that. That would be, you know, that might be the meal that I would want if I was ever, you know, having a last meal or something.
Well, we're about to ask you that. So that's
all right. Okay.
This is
well, that
excellent.
That would be a contender, yeah. And what else? Specific Welsh things.
What's the one that you talk about in stage? You talk about it, the fruitcake.
Oh, Bara Brith.
Bara Brith, Jesse.
Welsh fruitcake,
darling.
Didn't Luke Evans bring it to us, his mum's one?
Yeah, his mum made one for us, like a Bara Brith. Not exactly, it was more like a cake.
What about Welsh cakes? Have you had Welsh cakes?
Yeah.
I don't know if I have.
Well, they're sort of, how would you describe them? They're like
Eccles cakes, no?
Yes, I suppose, round.
They're
yes,
round,
I suppose. And then you have the raisins on them, it's, you know, pastry, and then with sugar on it. Now, Welsh cakes, if you go to anyone's house, or you know when you get, if you get invited to something in a school, or, you know, an official visit, maybe with UNICEF or something like that, to a school or something official, there will always be Welsh cakes if you go to one in Wales. So my life is mainly made up of going into rooms and talking to people and being given Welsh cakes. That's essentially 80% of my existence.
How's that going for you?
Well, I've had to spend a lot of time in lockdown trying to exercise.
Have you really been doing a lot?
I have exercised so much in lockdown. I mean, every day, like for at least an hour every day. All right, maybe that's not that much.
No, it's, but still, that's a lot.
Doing what?
I've got like an exercise machine that I can use, and I've got weights and stuff that I can use and all that. And I put on weight the last few years, definitely. And I keep sort of going, right, I've got to get back in shape, And I'm always sort of, I've been very lucky. I've been working a lot, and there's just never the time to kind of, you know, get into the routine with the gym and all that kind of stuff. So I've definitely got out of shape. So I thought, right, I'm going to be positive during this lockdown period, and I am going to get in shape. And I have been working hard. I've been cooking all the meals here in lockdown. I do everything, you know, in terms of the food stuff, and I've changed my diet, and I've had a really healthy diet. And the most frustrating thing is I got to weigh myself and I'm like 1 kilo lighter or something than I was.
But you know,
I don't
what?
Get it.
Do your clothes feel better?
He's wearing joggers and a t-shirt.
You don't know if he's wearing joggers. He could be wearing very smart
is.
Trousers. You don't
no,
bloody know.
I bet he's in his pyjama bottom.
I have nothing on below the waist.
Well, anything for comfort.
Yeah, it's very hot, as I said. I feel better, though, definitely. I definitely feel better. And, you know, our baby was 9 months old yesterday. And
muscle tough.
Yeah, thank you. And you know, you have to be fit because, you know, it's hard work. And just physically, it's hard work, you know, like, and so I knew I had to get in better shape anyway. So that's good. So I do feel physically fitter and stronger, and I'm sure everything else will take care of itself eventually.
So what have you been cooking during lockdown?
What have I been cooking?
Yeah.
Well, having spent so much time in America, it's, you know, you just sort of have takeaways and eat out and all that kind of stuff there so much. And so it's been a long time since I've cooked, really. And even when I did used to cook, I didn't cook much and I didn't have much of a range. So this has been a revelation to me in lockdown. I really have started, you know, getting more and more confident. And I might not have the greatest range of stuff, but I make a lovely salad every night. And I've been using turkey trimmings and couscous and salad. I use little pomegranates in the couscous as well.
All right, Ottolenghi.
Cook up some mushrooms with a bit of garlic and some pine nuts. Oh, man, why didn't anyone tell me about pine nuts earlier?
Pine nuts are
game changer.
The greatest thing ever.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
I want to know, when you are in New York or London or any of your kind of working cities, where are like the spots that you can't live without?
To do with food or
to
just
eat.
Generally? Or to eat?
Yes.
Oh, my goodness. So, I mean, here's the problem. There's nothing I like better than a diner. An old-fashioned diner. It's like when I was growing up in Wales. We have a tradition in South Wales, particularly, of there's a big Italian community, a lot of Italian cafes, ice cream parlours, that kind of stuff, South Wales-Italian connection. And there were some amazing cafes that you could go to. I mean, not posh, fancy cafes. You know, this is before the latte thing happened and all that. This is just old-fashioned, you know, big steel coffee-making urn thing in the background there. And you know, just really great cafes. And so I grew up loving going to those. And my favourite meal growing up was egg and chips in one of those cafes.
A
that was just my
spoon,
favourite.
Yeah.
Oh,
because their chips are always the best.
The best, the best. So in America, I love diners. I love the, you know, and not posh fancy ones, like real, you know, salt of the earth diners. But of course, the food is not necessarily the healthiest there. I love a corned beef hash in a diner.
Oh, yeah.
So there is a great diner around the corner from where I stay in New York. And there's also a very famous one called Jerry's in Los Angeles, near where I live. So I go there a lot. And there was another one called Izzy's in Santa Monica that I used to spend a lot of time in when I lived down that way. And they're diners I love as well because they're not just about eating there. Coffee is my favorite thing in the world, so you can have just endless coffee in these places. But I would go down there, especially when in the early days when I went to LA and I didn't have much to do. I used to just go down there to the diner, have coffee, corned beef hash, and then I would stay there all day and I would just read. I would read Stephen King novels in Izzy's Diner, having endless amounts of coffee. I would end the day a mess because I'd be terrified after reading Stephen King's book, and I'd have drunk so much coffee, I was just jacked up on caffeine. So I was a right mess then, but I do love a diner. But I was thinking about this earlier. I've been very lucky in that I've been for some extraordinary meals. I was trying to think of like the best meals I've ever had to be able to tell you about. And there's a place called, I was trying to think of the name of it. You've probably heard of it because I think it's supposed to be one of the best restaurants in the world. It's Blue Hill Farm at Stone Barns.
Is it in San Francisco?
No, this is up sort of...
No, it's outside of New York, isn't
that's
it?
That's it, yeah. And it's...
My friend went.
Oh, it's a restaurant, but on a farm. And you have a tasting menu when you go in there. And I mean, I've never tasted anything like it in my life. They, at one point, brought a tomato, just a tomato. And I tasted it, and it was the greatest thing I've ever tasted. I mean, the food is so fresh and amazing. It was incredible. But having said all that, it's still, for me, if we get back to the last, you know, your last dinner, you can't beat egg and chips. You just can't. Can't beat it.
And do you have condiments with that?
I like a bit of salt. My dad, growing up, watching my dad would pour the salt on and... the amount of time you would spend pouring the salt was longer than the amount of time you would spend eating the meal. I mean, that's how much salt my dad was having. And I've got a bit of that as well. And so I do like a bit of salt. So egg, chips, bit of salt. Ideally, maybe a bit of toast on the side to mop the egg yolk up. And maybe a bit of tomato sauce. Not too much tomato sauce, but a little bit of tomato sauce on the chips.
So is that your main, or is that your starter before you have your parsley and peas?
Oh my God, I don't think I could manage all that.
Jesse, he'd be sick.
Okay, so starter, main and pudding with a drink of choice.
All right, a starter.
Place that tomato from Blue Hill.
Yes, that or the other starter that I've had in the past that I really liked. There's a crispy, what is it? A crispy squid starter with a bit of like sweet chili sauce on it. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Oh, yeah.
I do love a bit of that. But also, I tell you what else you can't beat as a starter is crispy whitebait. If you give me crispy whitebait, if that's on the menu, I'm having it every time.
Oh, yeah, I love whitebait.
Every time. Oh.
With a good tartare.
Great, isn't it?
Oh, I do love that. And if I'm in a sort of a French restaurant, I do like a bit of escargot. Partly, I do like it because I love garlic. And so it's so garlicky, having snails. And I like the fiddliness of it. You get that little tiny fork thing that you get it out with. And I like seeing how other people react, like you just did, when I have snails.
It's a faff. And I'm a greedy cow, so it just takes too long. Like, I got prawns yesterday and I did them on the barbecue. And my children are like gannets for prawns, which blows my mind because I can't even get them to eat lasagna. So I'm like, you're watching me take the shells off, suck the head, and you're like, give it to me. My son, who can't, my 15-month-old son is like, But yeah, for me, it's too much of a faff. So that the idea of the escargot.
There's a difference. Yeah, there's a difference between faff and sort of ritual. Now, I don't like faff. Like, so prawns, I don't like shelling prawns in order to eat them. I can't stand that. But give me oysters, doing all the stuff with the oysters and putting the different bits on.
Yeah. I like that more than the taste of the oyster, yeah.
Well, and the snails, having the little fork in the snail. I like all that kind of thing.
Jesse's just not sophisticated, mate.
Oh, fuck off, Mum. You're the one that would absolutely never have a snail or an oyster. You say it tastes like snot.
Because I'm not sophisticated. I never said I was sophisticated.
So what's your pudding? What's your pudding?
Oh, pudding. I mean, I am a pudding person. I'll have anything. I don't really distinguish between high art and low art when it comes to puddings. I'll have anything. I mean, when I was a teenager, and I was a very active teenager, you know, I was playing a lot of football, a lot of sport. Even when I was acting, I'd jump around a lot. I mean, I just had a very high metabolic rate, or whatever you call it. I could eat anything. I used to demolish a bag of 12 jam donuts from Tesco's in one sitting. I mean, I would just go through the lot.
I'm so impressed.
And it would have no effect on me. I mean, it would have an effect on me. I'd be running around like a mad ass on a sugar high. But I didn't put weight on. So, of course, that's the problem. As soon as you get to the point in your life where that you can't get away with that anymore, my eating habits didn't change for a while. So I suddenly realised, I've got to exercise more. And I kept doing that. But left to my own devices, I'll go back to that. I've been trying to have sort of low-fat yogurt with grapes, blueberries, flaked almonds and pomegranate seeds and that kind of thing.
And?
Well, it's nice, but it doesn't do it.
Doesn't do it.
But can I tell you, Michael, don't do low fat. It's all a myth.
Oh, really?
Get the full flat. Yes, it's far more satisfying. It's got less sugar in it. It will fill you up for longer. Promise me, stop with the low fat. Get the full fat Greek yogurt. It will fill you up and it will be so much better for you.
What about a full tub of Haagen-Dazs instead?
Yeah.
It's delicious.
Yeah. Well, that's the problem.
You've got to buy Ben and Jerry's, though, because they've become great activists.
Oh, right, yeah.
Yeah, well, for the Black Lives Matter movement, yeah. They got arrested, didn't they?
Yeah, they got arrested.
Funnily enough, when I was in my local supermarket here in Wales, this was ages ago, and it wasn't long after I'd sort of moved back here. And we were going down the... And we were buying a tub of ice cream, you know, just a Haagen-Dazs type thing, a small thing.
Of course.
And I was standing there about to get it. And a woman came down the aisle. Well, I didn't know. I'd never met her before in my life. And she goes, trust you to be in the ice cream department. I was like...
What a bloody cheek.
I know. What a cheek. And I laughed, you know. And afterwards, I was like, hang on. What do you mean, trust you to be in the ice cream department?
Did she know something about you, Michael?
People do this. This is what people are like around here. They'll just say stuff like this.
She was the one serving you the 12 donuts when you were younger, maybe.
See, it's all come back round.
You probably remembered.
Never go back to where you grew up.
Michael, do you have good table manners?
Well, I like to think I do now. But, you know, when I when I first went to London... And this isn't really going to make much sense, I suppose, in the light of what I'd said about what food was like when I was growing up. But when I first got to London and went to drama school, people pointed out to me that when I was eating my food, we had like a little canteen at drama school. When I was eating my food, now I'm going to, people aren't going to be able to see what I'm doing, obviously, but you'll be able to see. I used to put my arm around my plate, apparently, as if I was guarding
like
it.
Like protecting it.
Yeah, as if someone was going to come and steal it. And I used to eat my food with my arm around my plate, sort of head down, like a sort of hunted animal, apparently. And when this was pointed out to me, I couldn't understand it. And then I remembered, oh, it's because my dad used to come and steal my chips.
Jesse, your children will be doing the same thing.
Oh, God, they will. I finish their meals. Are you now that you're weaning your child, are you kind of doing the finishing off? I mean, you're in pure... Are you past purees?
No, No. We're only entering the world of purees at the moment. So my other daughter, so Lily, my daughter who's now 21, she used to say, and still does say, that her impersonation of me eating food is me going, "Get your own! Get your own!" Which I think is also a consequence of my dad stealing my chips when I was a kid as well. It's like, no, get your own. Like, she says, you won't share, Dad. You won't share. I said, I'll share.
So you're the kind of person when you get a curry, you get your own korma or vindaloo and you don't share it with anybody else.
No, I've got much better at that. But on some basic level, I do feel like if everyone is ordering food, you order what you want. You take responsibility for your own choices when you're ordering food. You don't. I mean, we're not living in a commune, are we?
But what if you want the whole menu?
I know. I've come to now enjoy the experience of, you know, sharing and have a bit of this and a bit of that. I am better at that now. But for a long time, and I can still revert back, drop of a hat, I can be back into arm around my plate. Get your own!
What was in your lunchbox? If you had lunchbox or school did you dinners. Have school dinners?
I had school dinners.
What was in there? What
were
sandwich?
They good?
What do you remember from school dinners?
School dinners, oh, goodness me. Like custard that was more like blancmange.
Cake and custard.
Yes, cake and custard. Chocolate sponge and thick. I mean, not just thick custard, but like I say, I mean, it was like full-on blancmange. I remember that quite vividly. I remember, well, of course, cowl. They would give us cowl at school now and again. That was my favourite thing. I loved that. That was great. That's what, you know, that and my grandmother's cowl was what got me into all that. Well, I went through comprehensive school. Oh, my God, this is amazing thinking about this now. I went through comprehensive school having the same thing for lunch every day because my mum and dad, you know, would give me whatever it was, you know, £2.50 or something for lunch every day. And I would get a cone of chips from the indoor market at the shopping centre, and a raspberry slush puppy. That was the blue one. That was my lunch every day for 5 years.
For 5 years. Yeah. Oh, my God.
Yeah. I mean, it's a wonder I'm alive. But it is, though, isn't it? I should have got scurvy or something. Because it's not like I was getting high cuisine at home.
That is amazing. What's your karaoke song? Do you like karaoke?
I do. I love karaoke.
Me too. Jesse hates it.
But do you think that's because you're an actor and so you love... I mean, you're the best at characters from Chris Tarrant to, you know, you Tony Blair. Like, I mean, you are... Is it the thrill of being able to acquire that person?
Well, I do like that challenge. Yes, I do quite like singing songs, trying to sing like them.
Can you sing? Have you got a good voice?
I can sing a bit. It's all right. It's not great.
So who's your alter ego when you're in karaoke?
Well... One of the musicals that I would love to do is the Rocky Horror Show.
Oh,
so
yes.
One of the songs I love to do at karaoke is Sweet Transvestite. I love that song.
I thought it was going to be The Time Warp.
No, that's a sing-along, dance-along.
Yeah,
no,
I was just going to do it for you.
Yeah, I'm not interested in that.
Can you usually find this on the karaoke system?
You'd be surprised, yes. Okay. You find it in pretty much most places. Where I used to live in Los Angeles, when I first lived in Los Angeles, down in Santa Monica, at the very end of my street, there was a karaoke bar. So I used to go there a lot. Even when there was no one there, I would just go in and just have the whole place to myself. But I will still knock out a Sweet Transvestite, if you get my drift, if I'm in a karaoke bar. That didn't come out the way I meant it.
As much as it's a delight to hear your food stories, I feel like we both would love to leave this episode telling the listeners a little bit about UNICEF's biggest campaign for children.
Yeah, yeah. So they've got this appeal going called the Save Generation COVID campaign, which is to try and help the children in mm-hmm. Refugee camps around the world who are, you know, in such danger at the moment. This is the biggest global crisis for mm-hmm. children since World War II. And the danger is that, you know, new research has come out recently that says there is the possibility that an extra 6,000 children could die every day as coronavirus weakens, you know, national health systems and disrupts vital services. So this Save Generation mm-hmm. COVID campaign, there is an appeal and a fund that UNICEF have set up in order to try and, you know, save a whole generation of children that are in danger, really. So, you know, these are children who have already been weakened by war and disease and hunger and poverty. And their survival depends on healthcare and, you know, life-saving food and just basic things like clean water and medical supplies. So this appeal is the largest one ever for children in the 73-year history of UNICEF. So that says, you know, how urgent it is. And hopefully we can give people information to the to where they can go to donate, because it is just vital that these children, you know, after they've gone through so much already, are not left to bear the brunt of the coronavirus.
And I think, you know, for all of us, and look, it's been hard for all of us, but, you know, staying at home, this idea that, you know, staying at home and that we've been denied something, some children and families, vulnerable children and families, don't have the option to stay at home. And they're more exposed to this disease and more vulnerable. And so, yeah, we would love you guys that listen, all of you buggers that listen for free every week. We love you. But if you could just give a little donation, it would be so, so huge and make such an impact for this campaign.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard, isn't it? Because, you know, we both know that people are just hanging on at the moment, you know, in this country.
Yeah,
people
absolutely.
Are just having a really
totally.
Tough time. And so, you know, I say it with the proviso that if you can, then please do yeah. give what you can. But, you know, it's with the full awareness that, you know, people are just, you know, hanging on at the moment. So, you know, God bless you if you can.
Oh, Michael, it's been so lovely chatting to you. Thank you so much for doing this.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
It's just such a treat. You're amazing, and you do so much incredible
Thank
work.
You.
And
wonderful.
We love you. So
the only thing that you didn't do was just do the beginning of Under Miltwood, which I've never quite recovered from when you did that.
To begin at the beginning. It is spring. Moonless night in the small town. Starless and Bible black.
Oh, thank you. Made my day now.
Aww.
Michael Sheen, I mean,
he did Miltwood for us, Jess.
What a guy. Does so, so much.
He's a real philanthropist, isn't he?
Yeah, but kind of, I mean, he says he cringes at saying he's an activist. I mean, he may as well basically run the country if we could have him. God, give me Michael Sheen.
But do you know what? He's not angry, is he? He's just like enthusiastic and not say, oh, well, they should be doing this, they should be doing that. He just enthuses you. That's what's so clever.
Oh, that was just really lovely. And anybody who hasn't watched Stage, it's brilliant. It's on BBC iPlayer. They're so captivating, David Tennant and Michael Sheen. You could just watch him in anything, couldn't you? For more information on Save Generation COVID, visit unicef.org.uk and there will be an option to donate. Whatever you can would be amazing, but we understand if you can't. Thank you so much for listening. This was a goodie, and we'll be back next week for more. You can't get rid of us. The music you've heard on Table Manners is by Peter Duffy and Pete Fraser. Table Manners is produced by Alice Williams.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.